Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey, do me a favor, would you? Don't be spooked by all the scary headlines, because this economy is not so bad. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 28th of April. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. You know, it's possible that over the years on this program, you have been promised that there wouldn't be any math. And I like to think we've held mostly true to that. So your forbearance will be appreciated as we do just a little bit of macroeconomic math on this Tuesday. The equation is pretty simple. 2 plus 2 equals negative 1.4. Let me explain. We learned this morning from the Bureau of Economic Analysis that the American economy got smaller last quarter. It shrank the aforementioned 1.4% on an annualized basis. Here, though, is what you got to know about that. GDP, gross domestic product, the economic indicator in question, is the sum and total. You basically add up consumer spending and government spending, business investment, and net exports. And last quarter, January through March, right? It was those last two categories, business inventories in particular, and a surge in imports, which is net exports, right, that subtracted from overall economic growth. Two stories now to tell the tale. Marketplace's Justin Ho up first with inventories. Mitchell Hartman brings it home with imports.
When the pandemic started, businesses ran down their inventories. People bought a lot of stuff online. Meanwhile, many businesses shut down and didn't need to maintain inventories. But then things started reopening.
And now businesses are trying to ramp them back up.
That's Jennifer Lee, senior economist with the Bank of Montreal. She says surging consumer demand and congested supply chains have made it difficult to build up inventories. Take cars, for instance.
They'll sell very quickly, and then it'll take a while to get another round of new cars back onto the lot.
So businesses overcompensated by overordering. In the fourth quarter of last year, inventories rose by the largest amount on record.
So that set us up for a really tough level of inventory building to beat here in the first quarter.
That's Sarah House, senior economist with Wells Fargo. To be clear, inventories did rise in the first quarter, a lot. But the GDP calculation only cares about how much they changed. And since they didn't set a record again,
that's leading to the slower pace and therefore the drag on headline GDP.
This is what's known as a base effect. Since inventory growth was already high, that base is hard to beat. Business inventories are going to keep rising this year, and that'll be good for the economy, says Kathy Bosjancic at Oxford Economics.
The need to replenish inventories should keep, you know, manufacturing sector and industrial production still rather sturdy.
All right, so that was inventories. Your turn with trade, Mitchell.
A lot of the inventory that Justin just talked about, stuff being sent to warehouses, factories, and stores, it's imported, says Columbia political economist Sharon O'Halloran.
What you're really seeing when you have a big growing trade deficit is that we're spending more on the things we buy from abroad.
There's good news and bad news in this widening trade gap. The surge in imports means freight backups at U.S. ports are easing, says Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
You have all those ships, they are being offloaded in larger numbers. So we should be seeing fewer supply chain problems in the future.
The bad news, we're selling less to foreign customers. COVID lockdowns in China and Russia's war in Ukraine are slowing global growth, says Joel Kahn at the Mortgage Bankers Association.
The export number declined for the first time in a while, and that was likely driven by a slip in global demand.
Plus, the U.S. dollar has gotten stronger, meaning U.S. goods are less affordable abroad, which could hurt the U.S. economy in time, says Kurt Long at the National Association of Federally Insured Credit Unions.
the export-oriented manufacturing sector. I worry that some of the weakness in global demand is going to kind of wash back and potentially reduce labor demand for those employers.
Possibly leading to a slower jobs recovery or even layoffs at U.S. factories.
I'm Justin Ho.
And I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, hey, listen, you remember the other day all the red on the boards, the wailing and the gnashing of teeth? Yeah, never mind. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve get a lot of attention here and elsewhere because the Fed is the central bank in the biggest economy in the world. But size does not always matter. See also Japan. Because while the Fed, spoiler alert, is going to raise interest rates next week, today the Bank of Japan said it is going to keep rates low, low, low. Thank you very much. Marketplace's Lily Jamali explains what's going on.
By keeping interest rates low, the Bank of Japan is bucking the global trend led by the U.S. Federal Reserve. CIBC's Bipin Rai says the two nations are on very different tracks.
The United States economy is humming, whereas the Japanese economy is not doing so great.
The Bank of Japan's announcement hit the nation's currency, the yen, which was already hovering at lows not seen in 20 years. That makes stuff that Japan sends abroad cheaper and may help juice its economy, but not for a while, Rai warns.
The near-term effect is actually quite damaging if you have a significant degree of weakness in the currency. And the reason for that is because it passes through to prices in terms of inflation much quicker than it does towards trade.
So people in Japan will keep paying more for the many things they import. Meanwhile, Japanese salaries have stagnated for the last three decades, says Columbia's Takatoshi Ito.
Japanese should be really concerned about how to increase their wages and real income and consume more.
And Ito says allowing the yen to lose value today won't support the Japanese economy the way it used to, back when Japan manufactured more goods.
Many companies have already established the production base in the U.S. and Europe, so they are quite neutral from this exchange rate.
Inflation is back in Japan, but nothing like it is in the U.S. and Europe, which may explain why the nation's central bank is going its own way. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
The Senate voted earlier this week to confirm Lael Brainard as the vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, only the third woman ever to have that job. But with a couple of key Democratic senators and Vice President Kamala Harris out with COVID, Republicans blocked a vote on economist Lisa Cook, who, if confirmed, would be the first black woman ever to serve on the Fed.
It's pretty well known by now that economics has a race and gender problem, and this is something that we've finally been trying to address as a field.
Anna Stansberry is an assistant professor of work and organizational studies at MIT.
At some point, I noticed that a big thing that felt missing from the conversation was this other aspect of diversity, which was socioeconomic diversity. And I couldn't find even any data on what economics looked like, what other fields looked like. And so with my co-author, Robert Schultz, we ended up doing that research ourselves because we couldn't find any data on it.
And that research caught our attention. It's a working paper published by the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
And what we've found is that economics is actually the least socioeconomically diverse of any major academic discipline in the U.S. in terms of the parental education of people that get economics PhDs.
Is it possible to intuit or infer why it is this way in economics?
So we can kind of trace it to a number of different parts of the pipeline. Some of it is who's actually studying economics at the undergrad level. It's partly which schools offer economics and promote economics to their students. And then something else is happening in that pipeline further on as people go into graduate school. And I think that's more about mentorship and access to networks and access to knowledge about the right pathway.
You know, one of the things you hear a lot when you talk to economists about their field is a sense of Well, there's some pride and there's some hubris, I suppose, about how they're doing the most important social science work because their studies, their research actually influence policy, right? That they get into mm-hmm. government, they get into these think tanks, and what they do becomes law and it affects people's lives. This is going to sound like a stupid question to ask an economist, but is that why this matters?
Yes. No, that is exactly it. You've hit the complete nail on the head. I mean, diversity in any field matters if you want to ensure that there's equal access, you want to ensure there's no barriers. But the reason that I think we need to care about this as a society and not just as a kind of internal debate within economists mm-hmm. is exactly for the reason that you say, because economists are really influencing policy and the public debate on all sorts of important subjects, you know, unemployment, inflation, the welfare system. All of these are issues that disproportionately are affecting the people that are not the most privileged. And at the same time, if we have a discipline that is two-thirds of the US-born economics profession is made up of people whose parents have graduate degrees, you know, that's a very selected group that is maybe missing really important perspectives.
Yeah, it kind of gives lie to the whole peer review part of peers, right? I mean, that's
right. Yeah, well, exactly. You want your peers to be peers with different perspectives and different right. opinions, and you worry that we're missing a lot of that.
Right. So look, let's talk solutions here for a minute, because you alluded to that mm-hmm. a second ago. And I'm obliged to point out that a couple of years ago, no less a noted economist than Janet Yellen was the head of the American Economic Association. And despite her best efforts, and she made some strides, I suppose, but there's still a huge gender problem in economics. There's an old white guy problem in economics. What do you do to solve this issue, which arguably has a longer pipeline problem than some of the other issues that economics faces?
Yeah, clearly you've got to do things all the way along the pipeline. And if you look at gender and if you look at race, that pipeline is leaking all the way through the academic discipline. It's, you know, from age 18 when people are coming into college all the way through to whether people are getting very, very senior leadership roles. And so there are places that you can make an impact all the way through. For socioeconomic background, it seems to be the same, but we don't actually have data on all those points in the pipeline. I think a lot of the problems are to do with disproportionately intransparent access to opportunities, a role of insider knowledge. And a lot of that can mean that people don't know what a career in economics would involve, how to get there, what to major in, whose recommendation letters to get. And those kind of processes, that just helping people navigate them when it happens makes a huge difference. It just doesn't happen enough.
But, is there something... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think there's another set of things that are important, which is, I think part of the way economics is portrayed, particularly to undergrads and particularly in the kind of Econ 101 tenor of some of the public debate, misrepresents the field. I mean, it's economists doing it, yeah. So I'm not blaming anyone else. But you've got abstract math problems and people talking about terms that can seem kind of offensive, like low-skill or unskilled workers. And I can see why that would be off-putting to people. And they'd think, this isn't the discipline that is going to answer the questions that I care about. And so we're losing a lot of talent, I think, right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. Anna Stansberry is an assistant professor at MIT Sloan, writing... relatively recently, I suppose, about the socioeconomic problems that economics has. Professor Stansberry, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up,
having some payoff that benefits you.
Yeah, sign me up for that. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 614 points today, 1.8%, 33,916 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ picked up 382 points. That's a little over 3%. Ended things at 12,871. S&P 500 up 103, 2.5%, 42.87. Meta reported that its main product, Facebook, it's probably not Meta, right? It's Meta. Anyway, Facebook had a better than expected first quarter, picking up an additional 20 million daily users. That's after losing users for the first time ever in the previous quarter. Shares up more than 17%. Meta's good news helped lift other social media and tech stocks. Pinterest up 13.6%. Shares in Tesla started the day down hard after brokerage firm Wedbush reported investors were frustrated by Elon Musk using his shares in that company to finance his purchase of Twitter. Yeah. Tesla ended things down almost 0.5% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is a case to be made, and many have, that the war in Ukraine is the moment that big energy-consuming countries and regions, say the United States and Europe, ought to be rethinking things, using this moment to get out of the geopolitical traps that dependence on fossil fuels has gotten them into time and again. So we got Mark Brownstein. He's the Senior Vice President of Energy Transitions at the Environmental Defense Fund on the phone to test that proposition.
Look, there's no question that people see the high price of gasoline and that for many, this is a real economic challenge. And so it's understandable that policymakers will look for ways to reduce those prices in the short term. But the fundamental fact is, Kai, is that we have seen this scenario time and time again, where oil is proving to be an unstable factor in our economy. And now we have the opportunity to move to a different future.
Yeah, but it's a question of political will, right? And you don't have to look too much farther than the President of the United States releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and asking oil-producing countries, including reports are Saudi Arabia and Venezuela, to pump more oil as a way to address his political problems that this crisis now is presenting him.
Well, as I said, Kai, you know, there's no question that the high price of gasoline affects, you know, Americans and some Americans very much. But, you know, the very same day that the president announced a release from the petroleum reserve, he also issued an executive order that will make it fundamentally easier to produce batteries in the United States, batteries that will be used in cars and trucks that will allow us to get off of oil. And so I don't think the president is getting enough credit for the steps that he's been taking to take this moment and fundamentally move our country in a different direction.
Point taken, and I don't want this to devolve into a political conversation about Joe Biden's woes, although on the energy front there they are many, but this is now a question that is in some degree beyond his control. And you don't have to look too much farther than the jam that the Build Back Better program and his climate-friendly policies there are in, right? It's all but dead.
Well, it's beyond any one person's control in this sense. The fact of the matter is that the United States does not have the ability to set the global oil price. And the only way to, you know, fundamentally make a change is to decouple our economy from dependence on oil and the global market that sets it. There's currently $550 billion of clean energy investments before the Congress. And I believe that the Ukrainian situation is now causing some who perhaps before dismissed this as simply an environmental issue to now come back and take a look at this $550 billion as a strategy to help us move away from oil dependence and the geopolitical risks that it creates for our economy.
You have called for, you've written or said in remarks, we have to have, and this is the quote, the fastest possible transformation of our global energy system. Number one, how fast is the fastest possible in your mind? And what does that look like?
Economic decarbonization means accelerating the production of zero carbon electricity, using that zero carbon electricity to displace natural gas in our homes and businesses. And then for industrial processes where electricity isn't quite ready for prime time, how do you use green hydrogen and other advanced, what they call e-fuels, to make up the difference? The United Nations talks about the fact that we have about 30 years to make progress, considerable progress, if we're going to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. And the reason why that's so important is because if we fail to deal with the climate crisis, we'll lose somewhere between 11 to 14% of global economic output by 2050. So the costs are real, both for the economy and for livability on the planet, if we don't make progress.
Mark Brownstein is the Senior Vice President of Energy Transition. He's at the Environmental Defense Fund. Mr. Brownstein, thanks for your time, sir, and your expertise. I appreciate it.
Kai, always a pleasure. Thank you.
The spectacle it is, the National Football League draft starts tonight in Las Vegas, don't you know? And if you squint and tilt your head just a little bit, you can make the case that it's a bigger deal than the Super Bowl is. All 32 teams are going to be there, as will the incoming rookies who are hoping to become the league's next stars. And there is, of course, going to be breathless television coverage, all of which can kind of obscure the whole point of the draft, to let players leaving the college ranks go pro, yes, but also to create just a little bit of parody in the NFL, P-A-R-I-T-Y, right? That happens in theory by giving last season's worst team the first pick, and thus, again in theory, them getting the best player, thereby theoretically making bad teams better. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains how it works in actual practice.
Another way the draft is like the Super Bowl, the Las Vegas Police Department said it's expecting 200,000 spectators per day for 3 days. That's about how many people turned out to see the last draft before the pandemic in Nashville in 2019.
With the first pick in the 2019 NFL Draft, the Arizona Cardinals select Kyler Murray, quarterback, Oklahoma.
Cardinals fans were naturally excited about that pick. The year prior, they'd been the worst team in the league. 3 wins, 13 losses. And Murray did make them better. He was the 2019 Offensive Rookie of the Year.
Bursting free! Kyler Murray, burst and goal!
This year, the first pick in the draft was awarded to the Jacksonville Jaguars, who went 3-14 last year. The idea is that by drafting a talented player, a bad team will get a better shot at winning.
There's certainly evidence that drafts, reverse entry drafts, promote parity.
Brad Humphreys teaches economics at West Virginia University. He says the evidence started with Major League Baseball.
Competitive balance improved substantially in Major League Baseball after the introduction of the draft in the 50s.
After that, it was no longer a foregone conclusion that the Yankees would end up in the World Series every year. And that's basically why leagues want parity. Not to keep the Yankees out, but to make sure other teams have a shot at getting in. The problem with this plan is that it also introduces a perverse incentive, tanking.
Tanking is that purposeful underperformance with the ultimate goal of having some payoff that benefits you.
Nick Watanabe is an associate professor of sport and entertainment management at the University of South Carolina. He says leagues don't want teams deliberately putting out a losing product because fans hate it.
I think naturally we don't like the idea of people who are losing on purpose to gain something, right? It seems to be both against that sort of moral and ethical code in sport. And I think even within society, we don't like people who get rewarded for losing on purpose.
Former Miami Dolphins head coach Brian Flores alleges that the team's owner, Stephen Ross, offered a bounty of up to $100,000 for every game the team lost in 2019. Ross denies the accusations. The NFL is investigating and says Ross could lose the team if they turn out to be true. Now, the appeal to tanking is lose now so you can win later, but it doesn't always work out that way.
There's a little catch. You don't know that you're going to be able to draft anybody great. There's no way to know that.
That's David Barry. He's an economist at Southern Utah University.
For one thing, every single year does not have a player in the draft who is going to change a franchise.
Some leagues have acted to minimize the incentives for tanking. The NBA, for instance, uses what's called a draft lottery. Only the worst teams in the league get to participate. The very worst have a 1-in-7 chance of getting the coveted first pick. Now, all of this obsession with making sure there's parity among teams in pro sports leagues is pretty much limited to American sports. In the rest of the world, in soccer, for instance, finish as one of the worst teams in your league, and you're sent down to a lower one, which means less exposure and less revenue. David Barry at Southern Utah says, as commercially saturated as sports in the U.S. are, they're borderline socialist.
American sports are everything people think socialism is. Losers get rewarded, winners get punished. And the American owners, who are all devout capitalists, all buy into this because it benefits them.
But if the goal really is parity and fan engagement, then maybe the NFL has it right. 8 different teams won the last 10 Super Bowls. In Germany's Bundesliga, Bayern Munich just clinched its 10th straight title. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
I'm all in favor of the relegation model, by the way. Just, you know. Thought I'd throw that out there. All right, anyway, final note today on the way out. Kind of got lost in the big news about gross domestic product, but this being Thursday, we got numbers for the first time claims for unemployment benefits today. 180,000 people lost their jobs in the week ended Saturday. That's a lot of people, obviously, in absolute terms, but given where we were not all that long ago, it's pretty good. All right, we're out of here. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Really, it's more situational awareness, really, than context. Crude oil today, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, up 3%, $105 and change a barrel. What are you paying at the pump, huh? Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.